Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Good evening, everyone. I'm Ruthanna Marcifio, and this is Feed Your Head, Nutrition for Your Brain. Tonight, I'm so happy to have Dean Capone with us. And Dean can be found at deancapone.com. He is the first person I have talked to who actually is running, well, as a nominee for the 2016 presidential election. Hi, Dean.
Hello, Dean. How are you?
I am great. I'm very excited to have you. I've heard good things about you, and this past Monday on Stuart Alexander's show, Left Turn, AJ Signeri from Chicago was talking about you, and then he was on my show last night, and he was talking about you, and
oh wow.
So, and then I talked with Mimi in California, who has also been on my show, and he was telling me what a great guy you are. So, hey, you know.
Oh, thank you.
You come well recommended, let me put it that way. So,
Thank you very much.
That's a good thing, you know. I mean, enough people will,
I hope so.
Will not like different stances of yours as time goes on, so, you know, it's good to have a support system. You're
That's
in the Tampa
right.
Bay, Florida area, and
I
wanted to ask, I don't know if you're from there originally, but I wonder how you got involved in politics at all. When you became, like we say, awake and aware,
my goodness. Well, I'm originally from the Philadelphia area in a union town. Most of my relatives were in unions, and I moved to Florida in my teens. And I don't really know how to describe when I became attuned, but I was writing a big, long treatise for no reason when I was 16 years old.
Wow.
And it sort of went from there. Yes, I know. It sort of went from there. It was sort of a natural inclination, I suppose you would say. And I've been observing, you know, for a long time, and I became active in our party just a few years ago when we formed a local in the Tampa Bay area, and now we have to reorganize that local. So just sort of a natural progression, I suppose.
Okay. So, well, and then coming from a union town, where I suppose that mm-hmm. a lot of places around Philadelphia and Pennsylvania are union just
yes.
because of the mines and everything. So that
I don't think
have...
I had any relatives that weren't in union.
Wow. Okay. Yes, I would say most of mine weren't. I think I might have had mm-hmm. a few, but not. But so that was pretty much in your DNA, I mean, coming from there.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Wow. So then at 16... Just because,
yes.
You wrote this.
That's
amazing. That's mm-hmm. that's why, you know, I have such hope for so many of our youngsters, because, I mean, of course, some are, you know, like we've always had people that are a little bit more burnt out, which doesn't mean they don't come around. But we have
right.
such smart young people who haven't been fed all the garbage we were fed. So
right, it's true.
You know, they can see things a little clearer, and
mm-hmm.
so they want to be our future. Well, now you organized unions and this kind of thing, and there were elections and all. Why?
Mm-hmm.
When did you decide, hey, I'm jumping off this other way now?
Well, in my early 20s, I joined a very small splinter party, which was based here. So that was in my early 20s. And I think that in that period of my life, I was like searching for a political and philosophical home. and bounced around a little bit between very small splinter parties before I, you know. I had an interest in this party for about 5 years, but sometimes it takes a little bit of, you know, it takes a little time to work things out in your head and have the courage to sign your name to the card.
Right.
And that was the case for me, you know. That was my case. But I think that in retrospect, this party clearly represents what I, you know, believe. And so I'm happy to be aboard, and everyone, ever since I did join, everyone's been very encouraging and supportive. We, you know, good people.
Yeah, and we are talking about the Socialist Party USA.
So that's correct.
It's, as far as I have heard from several people, this party actually is the arms bearer of the party that Eugene Debs was
that's
in.
That's correct.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. So it has a great history. And I don't
long and tremendous history.
Yes. I don't know if you've heard this, but AJ said last night on the air that he considers you the neo-Eugene Debs.
Wow. Those are big shoes to fill, and I won't wear those collars.
Okay. Well,
that's amazing, though.
That's what he said. Eugene Debs was such a popular socialist, mm-hmm. that even in prison, he garnered something like a million votes. And that was way back before the country
right.
had 315 million people. So
sure, that was 1922.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think
yeah.
the difference there is just being taken seriously as a candidate like that back in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of work to do to get back there.
Yes.
In this party and in the country, because that was the time in the history of the United States where things could have happened much differently.
Yeah.
And we have to get back there.
Exactly. And you think, wow, I mean, this is practically 100 years ago, and
exactly,
you know, doing the battles.
The important thing for people to understand is just because it's been 90 years does not mean those ideas have gone 90 years back into the woodwork. We still have those ideas.
Yes. And people have still been in small groups and just personally still living those ideas and ideals.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It is time to bring them out more, though, to the mainstream. Mm-hmm. Agree and
very much so.
This is the perfect time. I believe the campaign is going to be on Now is the Time. Well, it sure is.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep,
that's quite impressive. I wanted to ask just a couple of personal things, though, because I know that you're married and you have kids. And how did the kids and your wife take to this when you said, hey, I'm going to run for president?
I think that in most cases, especially when it's a third party, I think that you do get the one eyebrow cocked kind of look, like, oh, are you really? And I think that must be a normal reaction, you know. But I certainly not negative. Just well, go do it then.
Yeah.
You know.
The eyebrows cocked. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
Are they going to be active in this campaign?
They'll decide that. I think that, you know, maybe when there's some traction, when they can see there's some results, they'll be happier to jump in because they are kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. At first, you know, let's see how it plays out, and they can make their decision if they choose to. I'd love to, sure.
Yeah.
Canvas doors.
Exactly. I mean, yeah.
Right.
That, So, yeah, but no, that's good. It's not something you're saying, okay, they're going to do this because I say so. But
right, exactly.
Whatever they're comfortable with. And
sure.
that actually is the way it should be. What about your friends that that you know, like local, when you told them, was it more cocked eyebrows, or had they seen it coming?
I think that's a different story. I think outside of family, it seems like it wasn't such a surprise. You know, it wasn't a surprise, and no one had the same reaction as my kids.
Yeah.
No, I think they could see it coming, and a lot of my friends, you know, I'm active here, and my friends are active, and I think, you know, maybe not to the extreme level of, you know, seeking the nomination for the president, but certainly. Mm-hmm. Higher office.
Right.
Wasn't, you know,
okay.
Surprising.
All right, so they didn't go around gasping and saying, what are you talking about?
maybe behind my back, but not to me.
Okay, well, yeah, we always have a couple cocked eyebrows again behind the back, but that's
right.
With the Uniparty, you know, which I just pretty much put the Dems and the Refugs there.
Yes.
They have a lot of money backing them. Sometimes it's the very same corporations that back both sides, you know.
Sure.
And third parties, and I'm not talking about the Green Party, because the Green Party is the capitalistic party and they do have some money. But, you know, the rest of us really, we don't have those deep, deep bottomless pockets to draw from. So what are you thinking? How are you going to be financed?
Well, it's true that no Fortune 500 company is ever going to give money to a socialist campaign.
Yeah.
If they did, that'd be, you know, there'd be more than just eyebrows raised if that happened. So,
yeah, there'd be that heads think, off of the people in charge.
Right. You know, it does come down to the campaign and the movement has to be based on people, individuals, you know, groups within our parties, getting socialists under a message that can be conveyed. It has to be grassroots. There's no doubt about it. Otherwise, you're never going to compete with their money anyway. But to have enough to have enough to make a dent, and what we need to do is keep making dents, you know, and pass that to even the next generation, and let them use our work to accomplish bigger goals. It has to start with, you know, in private individuals, the people. Supporting a grassroots movement. There's no other way.
Yeah. And I mean, and that actually means more. It doesn't get you where you want to be as fast sometimes, but it
right,
means
exactly.
More well, you know, when people who really don't have much money, and I would put most socialists in that category, when they,
right.
you know, give it up, they give up something. It's like, okay, this counts. This it really matters. Whereas a corporation
Absolutely.
Or some rich person, it doesn't really – I mean, the money spends just as well for sure, but it doesn't have the same energy attached to it because it's a tax write-off for them.
Exactly.
And so when your local whoever, you know, gives you $20 to put on gas to get to some town, you know, I mean, this really counts. So
exactly.
You are going to be in Chicago this coming week. There is the National Organizing Conference for the Socialist Party USA. And
right.
I know you're coming in on Friday. It begins, I believe there's a movie Friday night shown. And
that's
then
right.
Then it's the weekend and Monday. Alex has something planned for then too.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that the movie is about Palestine, and I saw that the Socialist Party USA just, I believe it was the 14th of this month, actually put some kind of a statement out about supporting Palestine. And they had evidently endorsed BDS before that, but this was a little bit more firm, and I was so glad to see that, because that's one of my big, things where I'm actually. So it's very close to my heart. And
yes.
I wondered, you know, there's so many people still in this country, mainly in the U.S. Other countries seem to be more aware of what's happening in the world. But
right. So
many people here say, well, what are you talking about? You know, Palestine, that's that place that's got terrorists, and what do I care? And, you know, we have still a lot of nationalists in this country. And there's a lot of nationalists in others, too. I was talking with a friend, you know, so I totally consider myself an internationalist. And at one time I did consider myself a nationalist, but my eyes were opened.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, how important do you think for the office that you're seeking right now is the international aspect of issues?
Well, I think that historically, for certain, socialism has always been an international-minded movement, and of course, for political action. And in the office that I'm seeking to hold, I think that it's critically important. It's equally as important as the economic situation in the United States, is the United States' present role in world affairs, which has to be recalibrated. And recalibrated in a significant way. And of course, that area of the world, I mean, I'm sure that you and I could go on for hours and hours and hours about the history of that area of the world and why we're really at this point. But no, I think going back to core questions, absolutely important, critically important.
It is. And I think that there's some, somehow we have to get that message across to the people in this country that we really are connected. Mm-hmm. That we aren't just on a big island in the middle of Canada and Mexico. We're part of the world community. So it's very important, I think, too. One of your points that you're running on, one of the issues, is a basic guaranteed income.
Yes.
And there again, I mean, since I first heard about that, I was just like, well, yeah, of course that makes sense, because then people, at least, we're not going to have anyone starving, we're not going to have anyone in the streets. And,
right.
You know, there's still, when I mention that to some people, they're just sort of almost the cocked eyebrow. It's sort of the tilted head kind of thing, you know.
Right. It's really, like, it provokes an amazing reaction, because people don't understand that. Certainly the money already exists to do this.
Oh, yes.
You know, the quote-unquote, what's been called the Cadillac plan of basic income would pay everyone a, you know, non-means-tested salary every year. And, again, it's called in the community the Cadillac plan, which so it would replace Social Security, it would replace lots of other entitlements, and the money, it wouldn't replace things like VA, you know, payouts and things like that. But most entitlements we fold into, we're going to pay you instead. What you do with that money is up to you. It makes perfect sense. The money is available now. There is a whole wide range of what is fair as far as a dollar amount.
Yeah.
But if you look at things like, you know, the food stamp program could be eliminated, right? by and large, certainly not in all cases, because some people would still have trouble making it. But
that's it, because we still would have, mm-hmm. I think we still would have cause to have some of these social programs, because because some people, let's face it, look around, do you know people who actually are making good money, I do, and they cannot budget it. They are so far in debt.
Right.
So So
that's
it
right.
would be the same kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
unless, you know, we don't really know quite how that might play out, but
right.
I do think we would still need, there still needs to be some kind of food available and on, because
absolutely.
Some aren't going to. I think that there would be less.
But then they'd be truly supplementary also.
Mm-hmm.
Things like food assistance would be truly supplementary.
Yes, yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And also maybe more, you know, when we've talked with people who advocate, you know, down the road, because of machines, automation and things, humans can work maybe 2 hours a day. And
yes.
Well, this is true, though. This can happen. And, you know, then you would
mm-hmm.
have all that time for family, for artistic endeavors, for travel, for whatever you wanted. And,
right.
you know, this whole thing about working 60 hours a week, it does not have to be that way.
That's
and,
correct.
You know, people work so hard to try to keep up with the Joneses. And, I mean,
right.
I know people with their motorhome and their boat and all this with no time to enjoy them because they're working.
And they
the couple
yards.
Is working, you know, 3 or 4 jobs to make the payments
mm-hmm.
on them. That kind of thing.
Right,
so,
exactly.
So I think the quality of life is really important. And I think
I agree.
That we can get a person, you know, many people really are not striving to be wealthy. They really want that
That's
roof.
Correct.
They really want the kids fed. They want a good education for their children. So if they don't have to worry so hard or so much about having that roof and
mm-hmm.
and the food, so they know they're going to garden, have community gardens maybe, and do these different things, but they know that if there's a bad crop, that they're not going to starve, that the kids aren't going to starve.
Right.
So that's where I think
the driving motivation of most people, I think the driving financial motivation of most people is to not have to worry.
Yes.
On Wednesday night if they're going to have food before the paycheck comes in.
Yes.
Or if their mortgage payment is going to be late. Most people do not want a whole lot.
No.
Our entire civilization is skewed toward wanting more and more, and people do fall into that trap. But most people want to be able to sleep peacefully at night knowing that they're okay.
Yes, and safe. And this is
mm-hmm.
what people in other countries, you know, the Internet has allowed us to meet people and become really close
right.
to them in other countries. And that's all they're wanting, too. It's, I mean,
right.
they want those basic things. So the basic
mm-hmm.
things really don't need to cost an arm and a leg. And with a guaranteed income, that would be possible. Then you can have people who are working at jobs that they care about. And,
exactly.
You know, and doing, pursuing their creative interests and things. So I think
mm-hmm.
it would make for happier people because this whole starving artist thing, that gets pretty old. And there's a lot of us artists who are, you know, pretty much in that starving category. So
that's very true.
So I like the guaranteed income idea a lot. And no, this isn't, you know, people say, well, you know, where's this going to come from, blah, blah, blah. So, well, you know, mm-hmm. we're talking about a whole shift in the system. And
right.
not so many corporations. We're talking about more worker-owned factories and plants and businesses and things.
Exactly.
So it's a whole shift. I don't
mm-hmm.
know. Do,
I mean,
do you,
and these are...
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Mm.
No, you go on. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, no, I was just going to ask, you know, I just mentioned that so many... people we hear talking in politics, they're willing to put the Band-Aid on something rather than,
right.
you know, surgically remove it. Or
right.
They're into Band-Aids, and that seems
mm-hmm.
like that isn't helping any of us, I believe. I don't know.
No. The Band-Aid approach does not work.
No.
I think that's, you know, we really ought to know better as a society that Band-Aids don't work. We keep doing that, and we keep wondering why it keeps happening.
Yeah.
It's happening because the system is not only flawed, but if you could go back to, if you could go rewind time right now to 1972 politics and capitalism, it'd almost be like, you know, extremely more productive and pleasant environment than what capitalism has become since then.
Why is that?
This is not capitalism anymore. This is some, you know, this is state corporatism, and it's out of control, you know.
How did that happen, Dean? How did it change like that?
I think it began to happen in 1981 with Reaganomics and the rise of the new conservative movement and the entanglements between Wall Street, Washington, and the right wing. You know, there actually was a neoconservative strategy to make the United States in that image. And it played out in 30 years, and we had new conservative president and a president following him with his hands tied.
Okay.
And all that only means that the system is now so corrupted that what you said about Band-Aid is certainly true. This everything has to be changed. This shift in everything we think about, you know, and why basic income is natural because we're talking about changing things, not. I'm getting on to a coughing jag here. I read something last night on the Bold Progressive website that said they have been responsible for, and Democracy for America has been responsible for, electing 802 progressive candidates in the last 4 years. My question is, where are those people? And
I was just going to say that.
What has changed? What has changed?
Like, really? 800 and some in four
right.
years? And
what has changed? Right.
Wow.
Do you hear any, you know, voice from quote-unquote progressive, quote-unquote liberal, that is not capitalist?
Yeah.
Right?
You're much nicer about it than me, because I've told people, to me, progressive is a dirty word now. It has become a dirty word to me.
It's a cop-out type of word.
Yes, yes.
You know, yeah. It can mean many things. We twisted as much as compassionate conservative.
Yeah. That's right. It's a cop-out. So 800 and stuff. That's interesting.
Yeah. What have they done?
Yeah, well, maybe they're getting their bearings, unquote. they have the waters and all of this. Yeah, okay. So, something else that is on a lot of people's minds or coming out of their mouth is the issues with the borders, and now
yes.
the United States has something like 60,000 children that have escaped from Latin American countries. And I hear people say horrible things about, you know, like sending them back, and the way they put it is not very friendly. And all of
Absolutely.
This, you know, tell me how you feel about that and what you think we can do.
I think that the 59,000 children that are in question, I think that we have an obligation, and it's an obligation that we took on ourselves. Those were to be allowed into the United States and homes found for them, their minors, and so on and so forth. I believe in essentially open borders.
Mm-hmm.
My position is that immigration to the United States is net positive socially and economically. We there's a recent study about the economies in Iowa and Nebraska are essentially driven by the immigrant populations in those two states.
Okay.
They fill most of the manufacturing construction jobs. They work and they contribute to society and they pay taxes and so on and so forth. This movement, the immigration question is really simply it's a racial question. What we have is we have a country whose immigration policy, when it comes to Chinese billionaires, is competitive. Nations compete for those people to come to their country. We'll give you $500,000 tax credit. We'll give you $2 million to move to Los Angeles. And if these were German or Irish or British people coming to our border, they'd be in. If they were Cuban, they'd be in as soon as they step foot on the shore. The difference here is simply it's a racial thing, for lack of a better term, that's cloaked in an immigration crisis. There is no immigration crisis. It's foolishness.
That makes sense. What you're saying about Iowa and Nebraska, I totally believe that. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I lived in Idaho. And if it were not for basically the people from Mexico at that time, there would be no Idaho potatoes, trust me.
Truly,
there was so many people up here. Some were legal, some weren't, and working.
Mm-hmm.
It really made the industry work. So, I see that. And some of the people, at least out there at that time, I knew a couple people who were sitting around complaining about all the Mexican people there working, and yet these were the people who were setting, trust me, just setting and lying on every form they could find to get government help. I mean, it wasn't like they were going to work in the fields or in the factories, but they were going to complain to others who were willing to. So that's
And I think that's an endemic thing in our culture. And in Iowa and Nebraska, I mean, it's quite a huge percentage of the construction and agricultural work.
Mm-hmm.
And if those people weren't there, no one would do that work because just what you just said, the people who, those are not easy jobs to fill.
They're not. And here in Illinois, I don't know if there's as many, I mean, now because things are more mechanized and all, but there's still a lot of quote unquote migrant workers.
Sure.
And nobody is knocking them down to get in line to do these jobs.
Right.
Because
their
they are
still need to be done. Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's called stoop labor, and there's a reason. Because it is rough stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I just hats off to the people who do this and who come and then, go back to Texas or whatever because some that are legal will just, they live in Texas and they come up for, a few months. But, the thing about the children, that was really, I mean, it's just sad to hear some things that people say about them.
Well,
because
especially in the Republican Party who believes that every child or potential child is good. Well, I have 59,000 children that need a roof and some food.
Mm-hmm.
Where does your double standard end, right?
Yeah. Well, right, because, the Republicans are so big on, so many of, at least the right-wing fanatics, and it seems like there's more of those, I don't know.
Right.
They're so against abortion because life is valuable, children are valuable, and women shouldn't own their own bodies.
59,000 children, right.
Right, so here we have
9,000.
And it's like, or in Palestine or other places where we are fighting or our money is fighting and killing children, that doesn't count because those children, little white kids, is
exactly true. I think that plays to the core of it.
And that sickens me. That really It really does.
It's an extremely cynical, you know, point of view. And it's caustically cynical. It disgusts me as well.
It is. What do you think, you know, all of a sudden it seems like our country, and it's not the only one in the world, seems to be heading more into the fascist direction. What caused this, Dean?
Money. I think that money is, you know, I think there are periods in society in history of Western culture where things, you know, ebb and flow. Certainly in, you know, whether people like to actually address the core causes of World War II, anti-Semitism and fascism were rampant throughout the United Kingdom and the United States, the ideas. And in many ways, Britain was the, you know, birthplace of fascism and anti-Semitism in the 1920s and 30s. I think that that happens here in Western society in a cyclical fashion, and I think it's happening in the United States now on many levels because of protection and contribution of money from the radical right, media controlled by a few small companies, or very large companies, but small numbers of companies.
Right, like six maybe or something, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, even in our youth, that was unheard. That would have been unheard of.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Yeah.
You know, it was illegal. So consolidation of media, big money to the two political parties, the intersection of the right wing and Wall Street, and those conditions lead to a general feeling of, you know, pressure in the society, in white society, that we're being outnumbered and everyone's against us and we need to take action. And the way you take action is to start hating people and identifying groups of people whom you hate. And certainly this is a situation that has to be, you know, turned immediately, because things, you know, things in the United States and in the West are certainly in a house of cards mode at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, things could collapse. Things could, a group could take control of any country in the West, and, you know, fascism could be reborn again. What you said actually frightened me. So,
yeah.
Because it's true.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's very frightening because that years ago I had read something about the, like, neo-Nazis in Britain, like you were talking about Great Britain, and
yeah.
I was just like, my goodness, I hadn't a clue that something like that
right.
was you know, happening. And now, I mean, I was aware then when I lived in the West, Aryan Nations, they had a foot in the northern part of Idaho, in
right.
some of the most beautiful country on the planet, and which was sort of ironic to me. But so I knew they were around. I mean, we know these, you know, they're little groups here and there. But my goodness, it seems like so many people are leaning in that direction. You're saying, well, money, the love of money is the root of all evil. This is true. So,
yes.
Yeah. It's really.
Yeah. Money stirs up bad passions in small people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
That's something. It's not pleasant, but it's very true.
Yeah.
And somehow it's. I don't understand, because people from both specters, people who have no money are envious of those who do, and yet they fall into, because so many of those people go to the right.
Exactly.
I don't understand that. You don't have it yourself, and you're going to support people who have, you know, so much, like supporting
sure.
companies where the CEO makes $23,000 an hour when that's more than
right.
this person makes in a year, and they're going to support
exactly.
that? I
and
don't
fight for that person.
Yes. So
right?
It's so convoluted.
Well, I did read something that was interesting. I forget the quote. It is a quote from someone. I forget by whom. But the gist of it is if you can convince people with nothing to fight for people who are billionaires, you've done an amazing sales job.
Yes.
Right?
Truly.
And that has happened. I don't know how. But
yeah,
that has definitely happened.
That would be like a crowning thing for Madison Avenue, because for
yeah,
years
absolutely.
They have fascinated me with the ability they have to manipulate people, and
sure.
you know, in politics, right down to the commercials that people watch on TV, and
absolutely,
and you know that they have really chartered the lives of people. Somebody
mm-hmm.
told me the other day that the campaign for Obama, actually the people who structured it, they got some kind of awards in some kind of a big thing for, you know, campaigns of the year or something.
Right.
They received, and it's like, my goodness, I think I had known that but forgot it, and then they told me again, and I was just like, isn't that disgusting? I don't know. What do you think about, like, the kids that were turning out? We were talking about the brilliant kids, but then what about so many are not really taught in school, it seems, because the teachers have to teach to pass the exams. The kids need to pass the exams.
Right.
And they turn out little drones, practically. I mean, that's what the schools seem to want, the little robots.
Right.
Not really
mm-hmm.
teaching them to think for themselves anymore, because that's dangerous for the state, and they don't want them to be creative, because they're, again, that's dangerous for the state. It seems like they just
want to... I think it's even lazier than that. I think that there used to be a network of teachers' colleges in the United States, and there are very few of them now. I think you begin with undertrained teachers who
okay.
aren't paid enough money,
right.
who aren't paid enough to do the job. In a school, it doesn't generate enough, doesn't have enough money to work with. And I think that a lot of, I'm not speaking curriculum, I'm speaking about the role of teachers and schools today is basically to keep these children contained for 6 hours without having fights and without having, you know,
babysitting job. It's a babysitting
right.
Baby tenders,
yes.
yeah.
Right. And I think that, you know, one of the campaign positions that I have is that for 2 years of voluntary national service after high school, which would be, you know, to pursue your discipline, earn some money because it would be paying. My son was in a similar program, actually.
Okay.
And use those 2 years for, you know, education, deciding what you're going to do and getting a jump start in doing it. Certainly, even that won't work if the school system continues to be eroded.
Yes.
If there are people who are successful in privatizing what are now public schools, which is dangerous ground, and I think the Koch brothers are pro that.
Oh, sure. Privatizing schools is immoral.
Yeah.
It's totally, yeah.
Right. And I think so. I mean, I think that when we talk about radical shifts, certainly the role of education in the United States has changed after World War II. Pre-World War II, it was to turn out the, you know, that was your primary education. So you needed to come out with basic skills to
yes.
live in life. after that, it's, you know, let's try to get the 7 hours in one piece.
Right, right.
Curriculum has not been updated. Textbooks are ancient. Schools are falling apart.
And textbooks also don't lie. I mean, like history books and different things.
Yeah.
So they're not getting the truth anyway. Not that I did
right.
either, but these kids for sure aren't. So,
but
yeah.
if you're educated enough, you have the ability to discern the truth for yourself, right?
Yeah. That's, I mean, I just compare it, though, because I had teachers
yes.
that, I had a lot of teachers who actually loved what they did.
Yes.
And, you know, I'll never forget an algebra teacher I had in high school who, I never really caught on algebra is not my thing, but this woman so loved it. I mean, you could just see,
right.
you know, give her a piece
yes.
of chalk. In a blackboard or something. I mean, she was just, and I've had a lot of teachers like that in a college.
Yes, me too.
They would mm-hmm. come bouncing in, and I always wanted to sit in the front row because, I mean, it was just the energy, and they loved what they were doing. And I don't have anybody
mm-hmm.
like that anymore, you know?
No.
No,
that's...
It's just not, they just don't have that enthusiasm. Somehow.
No.
Like you said, though, the pay is really dreadful.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago in Chicago, I was talking to a cab driver, as I always talk to my cabbies, and he was talking about a teacher he knew who had, she had just recently quit, and he was feeling so bad, but he said she couldn't afford it anymore because she was buying the paper and the pencils and the toilet paper for her class.
Right.
And, you know, it's, and now Chicago just closed 50-some schools. Good
right.
old, you know, had. And
mm-hmm.
so some of those kids will not go to school now because
exactly.
They have to cross areas that are at war with them. And
right.
and the parents can't not go to work so that they can take their kids
mm-hmm.
to school. So the kids aren't going to be
right.
getting any kind of education now.
Exactly.
So, and I mean, that's... I, as much as I, it bothers me the religious schools in many cases
mm-hmm.
because they're the ones that are teaching like against evolution and different things, you know.
Exactly.
But I have to admit that they're usually turning out kids that can read and write.
Exactly. That's
so,
true. And
I mean, and that hurts my heart that that it has to come from schools that may be teaching them other things that aren't
right,
you know, to their advantage. But I've seen how some people recently out of college
mm-hmm.
they can't write a paragraph that is a paragraph, and
oh,
you know,
absolutely,
it's and when so many youngsters now get into college, they have to take remedial classes because they never
right.
learn how to read
mm-hmm.
or write. And so that's something that should have been taught in, you know, grade school. So,
just
yeah,
basic, you know, basic grammar.
Basic. Oh, yes.
Right.
It's just not
you
there.
Know,
so,
I've seen that in some people that actually surprise people with master's degrees.
Oh, yes. Yes. It was horrible. About a year or so ago, my brother's taking some classes and he brought home, he was heading, you know, one of the little groups in here, and everybody was supposed to write on a certain topic, and he was going to compile this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like me when it comes to sentences and things. I mean, when we're writing things, we, like, call each other, and we try to figure out the exact word to get this meaning. You know, we get sort of funny
right.
sometimes about that. Well... He was, like, banging his head, and I read these things, and these were adults. This was an adult class, basically. Well, there were a couple of people who were, like, of, quote-unquote, college age, early 20s, but there was even people, like, there was somebody who was in his 50s, and, you know, on. Anyway, there were, I think, about 8 of these papers. Oh, my God. And all I know, the topic was their assignment had been to go to the Holocaust museum kind of thing in, I think it's in Skokie, in
right.
the Chicago area, and just report on what they felt and what they saw.
Mm-hmm.
It just was the most I was laughing so hard because I thought if I don't, I'm just going to cry. And I said, you know, like, good luck, Casey. Have a ball with this, you know. Putting together what these people wrote, it was criminal. And it's like, okay, these are college students. So that was like, I couldn't, yeah. And this is what people are doing. And these people, they all had, you know, they thought that they did a good job. So, yeah.
That's sad and disturbing.
It was very disturbing. Yeah. So I don't even know.
It's just like, I mean, as an aside that goes with that point, it's just like how much I hated writing in cursive as a child, but I can still do it. And now no one can do it.
Exactly. Yes. Oh, I ask people about, you know, if I go to a store and somebody makes change for me, mm-hmm. I actually almost lose it because usually they say what, you know, they take what's in the cash register, what it says, and they just drop it in your hand and say, thank you. Because they don't have account change. And, you know, little things like that, though, I don't know. I mean, if the modern age, I guess it's just like, well, this isn't important anymore because this tells you what to do. So it's a whole different thing, but I don't think there's anything wrong with a few basic skills that we learned. Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with those being passed on.
What's funny about it, I think that even though, you know, we tease and joke about it, I think that the lack of certain fundamental things like being able to count change,
yeah.
or spell, those are actually systemic of a breakdown in what is important. And, you know, education will always be the most important thing.
I think so. I think it's so important. I mean, that's where you get all these ideas and, you know, you're turned on to reading this and that and trying this in the lab and doing these things and using your brain. So when that goes down the tubes, then you have the robotic drones that those in charge want, which is very sad. So, we've got to start with education. It's very – so what can we do? What do you suggest for teachers? Or I like your two-year national service program. Would that be what some of us have talked about, like working on the infrastructure of the country and things like that? Or would it be
It could be. In the example of my son joined AmeriCorps.
Oh, okay.
And he was assigned to the Montana Conservation Corps. So he was actually, you know, working in forestry in Montana, and he had a chance to go to some Native American communities and learn from them. And it was a wonderful experience for him, and he made $300 a week and could not have been happier.
Wow, yeah.
And he ended up with like $5,000 for college on top of that. So that exists in the country right now. It's not on a big enough scale, but I think that's a great opportunity for before someone jumps into the quote-unquote labor market or whatever they're going to do as soon as they graduate from high school.
Right.
National service would allow them to do infrastructure work, sure, or whatever was available in their discipline, wherever it was in the United States, to go and help themselves by helping the community at large. I don't think that's much to ask.
No, and I think that's wonderful.
If they were paid for that and had some of their school, you know, their college debt erased for in return for that service. There are a number of ways to implement it.
Education should be free. Yeah, yeah.
I believe that is true, and I think there should always be a place for private schools. But what's happening now is that private schools are simply the choice of people who have a little bit more money who don't dare send their children with the hoi polloi.
Exactly. Something may be off. Yes. Yeah.
Right. You know, I think that the education system in the United States does have to be overhauled in the way that we think about it. You know, we are lazy because no teachers have to go spend their own pay on toilet paper and pencils and notebook paper for their children. And still not have enough money to pay their own bills.
Right. And have to, like, leave that job to find another job that, you know, might be maybe the same pay, but one she doesn't have to give back so much to, kind of thing.
Exactly. So I think that, you know, it's a situation there of national just laziness. Politicians squawk about these problems, but the solution to that is not a test. It's you know, teachers who are trained, who have a passion to teach children who are in school, you know, and are in an environment where they can learn productively, and to raise, you know, intelligent human beings in the process.
Without stifling all of that one enthusiasm that they have.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I mean, so many kids, that they start out with that, but by the time they're through, they don't have it. And that's where your 2 years comes in. I love that, because I said for quite a while that I think after 12 years of school, before people go to college, they should take a year off and travel or bum around the country or something, because if they see different things, they may actually change their mind on what they want to do, rather than go on to 4 more years of college and then find out you don't really want to do this anymore. So I think that's a good break. And, I mean, it's
absolutely
just being, you know, such a time for learning. Probably in those 2 years, I'm sure he learned a lot more than if he would have gone right into college, because he learned about getting on his own. I mean, about having the money and doing something with it, from the Native Americans, forestry, all of these.
Right.
I mean, what an education. So,
yeah.
And that's called AmeriCorps. Wow. Yeah, I had not heard that. So you're right. Then it's, I mean, it's on a smaller scale. We need big things.
Absolutely.
So
I think
should know about these, that they can just go into this. That would, it looks good on a resume too. I mean, you know.
Yeah, totally.
Really, it does. We've only got 2 minutes, Dean. This has gone so fast. What would you want to leave words of wisdom? And we'll have you back for sure. But tonight's words of wisdom are what?
I'm looking forward to my week coming up in Chicago, for one thing. I think, you know, my take on the conversation, I've appreciated my conversation with you right now, because to be able to talk about these issues, many people, when we discuss these issues, are doing it from a place of, I call it, negativity. Everything's wrong in the world.
Oh, okay. I'm an optimist.
Always things wrong in the world. We have to, you know, it's actually people like you that are optimistic and happy. We can change these things if we keep at it and are serious about it. Many people hear the S word, the socialism word, and are afraid of it. And I think that's humorous, because it's never, you know, it's not ever going to get adequate play in our lexicon today.
No.
But let's take a look back at where the country has been and where the movement was 100 years ago, like you opened our conversation with. We do these things, and the tools are available now. And the only thing stopping us from doing it is, you know, our fear of being overcome.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to change that.
Yeah. There's one thing, being fearless, and it's like, we're not always fearless. Sometimes we're very fearsome, but it's just take that step. Go ahead and do it. You know, like they say, speak out, even if your voice shakes, just do it.
Yep.
And then pretty soon your voice won't shake anymore.
This is true.
So just take the step.
Thank you so much, Jan.
Thank you very, very much. And Chicago, yes, here you come. So
better be warm, like I said, but thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Well, you have a good weekend. And you know
what?
You
too, and I'll talk to you very soon.
Okay, we're going out with one of my favorite songs. Guess what? Love it. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Ruth Ann.